broadcasting live from the KSHP studios in the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. It's time to get on the right side of sports betting. It's time for the Odds Couple.
Welcome to the Odds Couple on the world famous Vegas Video Network and KSHP AM 1400 radio. My name is Scott Pritchard. I'm the founder of PritchardsPicks.com. You can also check me out at VegasInsider.com. I'm joined today and every day, GM of KSHP, sports enthusiast Brett Grant. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, Scott, great to be here as always. What a great day. What a beautiful night last night, and should be another good day of sports today.
Absolutely. Can't wait to get started with what say you. Last night, college basketball championship game, number one Louisville knocked off number four Michigan by 6 points. The final score was 82-76. Interesting, the point spread for this game was four. Not much disparity from 3.5, 4, 4.5, depending upon when you might have bet it. And the total for the game was anywhere from 137, 138, 139. And as we talked yesterday before we went off the air, we leaned on Louisville minus the points. We leaned on the over. Interesting, 10 straight times now that Louisville went over the posted total. But what I want to talk about with you, Brett, is the fact that a lot of people are saying that this might have been the most exciting college basketball championship game in the history. What say you?
Boy, I don't know if it ranks up there as number one all time, but it was a great game. And when you look at that first half and you got guys like Spike Albrecht, who was unconscious in the first half, making 4 for 4 from three-point range in the first half. And then Luke Hancock for Louisville, who was perfect from three-point range. The benches were phenomenal last night. And when you look at that kind of production off the bench from, I would say, what say you would be, who's Spike Albrecht? And, you know, Trey Burke was in foul trouble. He sat on the bench. Maybe John Beilein should have brought him off the bench when Louisville made the run and came back and made it a one-point game at halftime. But you knew Louisville was going to make that run. And then coming out of the locker room, it was a terrific game. And I went back and looked at it. And we talk about the total quite a bit. And we talked about scoring being down in college basketball for the year. But you look at the last, since 2000, the national championship game, the champion has scored 80-plus times, 7 times in those 14 games, going through. So it's they've been high-scoring national championship games, and last night was the same way.
Very interesting. Again, Louisville, their last 10 games went over the posted total. In fact, scoring overall this year has not been this low since 1951, 1952, 131 points per game overall. But now let's take a look at, you know, good teams find a way to win. Louisville, the top overall number one seeded team going into the tournament, they found themselves down 12 with 13:35 to go Saturday, final four game against Wichita State, came back to win. Last night they were down 12 late in the first half, went on a 14-1 run, and then ultimately came on, not only won, but covered the point spread. It lends itself to a deep, well-coached team, the ability to overcome adversity and come from behind and win.
Well, when you look at if the stars aren't producing, who's the outlier player? Who's the guy that's going to pick up the slack? And Russ Smith had a horrible shooting day yesterday. He was terrible, made one basket in the first half. He ended up 3 of 16, I think, totally for the game. And then you look at what Hancock did off the bench, 22 points off the bench. Shane Bohannon on the boards last night, 12 rebounds, 15 points. And then obviously their star did perform in Peyton Siva. He was terrific yesterday, scoring, distributing, making free throws down the stretch. But without Russ Smith scoring, you didn't think Louisville was going to be as good going into it. And, of course, they're without Wade with the broken leg going in there as well. So they're really down a big spot. And then on the other side with Michigan, foul troubles were a big factor for them last night. And they had to have that production from Spike Albrecht. Otherwise, they'd have been blown out of the gym last night.
Looking at Louisville, I mean, Luke Hancock came to play last night, made all 5 of his 3-pointers, 22 points for the contest. He had a great tournament.
He was named the most outstanding player, and I think it's the first time ever a sub has been named the most outstanding player for the tournament. I'm not sure he deserved it. I would have probably myself given it to Peyton Siva, but when Kevin Ware went down with his injury, Luke Hancock scored 52 points from that time against Duke, through their semifinal game, through their national championship game. He was terrific for Louisville, and that's what happens with good teams and good depth is you need somebody to step up and fill that role, and obviously he did a wonderful job at that.
Feel-good story for the Cardinals, Louisville, Rick Pitino, the coach, and then Kevin Ware, you touched on the fact that this is the guy who broke his leg. It was so cool to see him interviewed on national TV after the game, the fact that he said, this team is so close-knit, they're a band of brothers. They flat-out had fun. Again, a very loose team, but a very deep, talented team. I was very happy for the Cardinals.
Well, you look at Rick Pitino, and any great coach, and I think he did a wonderful job of deflecting the credit and praising the kids. He called them so tough, and he went right to Shane Bohannon and said, if he wasn't as strong as he was on the backboard, they don't win the game. And he was right. I mean, there was wrestling matches underneath the basket last night, and the referees, I think to their credit, let them decide the game underneath. They got a little physical in spots, and there was a couple of calls I thought that went against Michigan. Clearly, the block that Trey Burke had on the Peyton Siva dunk attempt was not a foul. Clearly, the block that Gordy Zhang had was goaltending that they didn't call. That would have been points for Michigan and then not points for Louisville. And we might have had an overtime situation last night, or at least a two-point game late in that spot. But I think overall, I like it when the referees let them get physical and play basketball underneath. They were hard fought. There was no elbow swinging. Guys fighting for the basketball, fighting for the national championship, and that's what I like to see.
It was an intense game from a sports betting standpoint. We touched on the fact that this Louisville team, again, we've talked about how when you're betting sports, you want to ride the wave. You want to ride the streak, winning streak, losing streak, whatever it is, try not to buck the trend. And we sat here and we talked about Louisville, 9 straight overs. We liked the over. Red Rover. We loved the over. It got there. Saturday was a case in point where I tried to buck the trend simply because I played under the 134. I was against the move, but I was still getting potentially 3 points the best of it because it did open 131. Right. And it was a photo. Could have went either way. But interesting how history has a way of repeating itself, and last night, no exception.
No, you're right, and we thought about it going into it. Obviously, the pace was terrific from the beginning of the game on, and with Albrecht making the three-pointers for Michigan, they got scoring from an unsuspected source, and then Trey Burke was very good in the first half before he got his second foul because he had a great first half where he made 3 three-pointers, I believe. He was 7 of 11 total for the game, but it was limited because of the fouls, and John Boehlein chose to sit him for a good portion of that first half when Louisville was making their run back, and with him on the bench, Louisville got a barrage of points. So when you look at halftime, 38-37 in a one-point game, you're saying, oh, 75 points. We love the over now because look at the pace of points. And provided that these teams don't go into a 7 or 8 minute lull of no points being scored, you figured there'd be fouls towards the end of the game. But when they came out in the second half and the pace stayed right where it was in the first half, the over was never in doubt. I think it went over the total about 3 minutes to go in the game. And when you have that nice, easy, no sweat to it, you like that.
Well, from the odds makers know that they will shade it one way or the other. The first half total for last night's game was 63-64. It fell 75 at 38-37. So having bet the over at 137.5, I was feeling good about myself because, again, we know, generally speaking, they shade it. There's usually about 10-point discrepancy between the first half right. and the second half. And you have an outside chance of it going overtime, which lends itself to the over. The last minute, minute and a half, a barrage of fouls leads to cheap points. So that's why they shade it one way or the other. I really prefer betting first halves because I don't have to worry about will they foul, will they not foul. Right. I don't have to worry about will it go overtime, will it not go overtime. So I like to minimize randomness. And so you have somewhat more predictable situations in the first half. I do want to comment on an outstanding year by Trey Burke, the star player for Michigan. Now, he struggled Saturday, Final Four game against Syracuse, only 1 for 8 shooting, missed 2 critical free throws. But last night, wow, he came on 24 points and really did his job. The only concern was the fouls.
Yeah, he was terrific. And you know, the interesting thing from the Michigan side was you look at Nick Stauskas, who had been terrific in the previous game and in their Elite Eight game, only took 2 shots last night. He played 19 minutes, and maybe some of his shots were taken away because Albrecht played 28 minutes last night and played probably more than he normally plays. But he was a guy that Louisville decided he wasn't going to beat us. So they made sure they shut Stauskas down going through. Hardaway kind of had a mediocre day shooting, but the team, Michigan in general, shot 52% from the floor. So it wasn't a night of which they couldn't put the ball in the basket. They were scoring and scoring very well against a very good defensive team in Louisville. And we talked about yesterday just the pace of the game. If you know, Louisville will play whatever pace you want to play, and they feel very confident they could win at whatever pace that you want to play. And Louisville didn't shoot it necessarily as well, 46%, but they turned it over. They won the offensive glass. They won the turnover battle. They won the free throw line. And they were a higher percentage from three-point range as well going into it. But I thought Trey Burke was terrific last night. And maybe the only questionable move, again, was should Beilein have brought him back in the game and risked him getting his third foul in the first half to stem that run by Louisville towards the end of the first half?
I think we need to salute the Wolverines of Michigan, an outstanding season, a 4 seed getting to the NCAA college basketball tournament. Hard-fought game, up 12 in the first half, ultimately ended up losing by 6, 82-76 the final. But this is a team that had not been to the Final Four since 93, the Fab Five team that made it to the Final Four in 92, again in 93. And, of course, they won it all in 89, winning in overtime against Seton Hall. So a storied franchise in Michigan, and hats off to them, a great season.
Well, and a very young team. And you have to suspect that the majority of those guys, with the recruiting class coming in, which I hear is very, very good, they should have an excellent team again. Next year, you figure McGarry coming back, and you, obviously you lose Burke. You'll probably lose one or two the other guys to the NBA as well. But with McGarry coming back with a year under his belt, Stauskas and Albrecht and the recruiting class coming in, they'll be very good again. And when you look at college basketball this year, even though Michigan was a number 4 seed in the tournament, if you looked in December, they were number 1 seed. There were probably 16 teams that could have been at one point or another a number 1 seed in this tournament, and Michigan was one of those teams.
Very good point. I do want to shout out to Rick Pitino, outstanding coach, obviously. He became the first coach to win championships at two different universities, Kentucky back in 96, and of course last night with Louisville. And it was kind of interesting at the end of the game, post-game, they interviewed him, and you can tell that it's close-knit family there. He's a player's coach, but he has control of the team. He went on record as saying, I don't know if you saw this, that the players, so many of them have tattoos, and they said, Coach, if we should win the championship, will you get a tattoo? And Rick Pitino said, hell yes.
Right. The question is, what's it going to be? It's going to be a Kentucky tattoo, a Louisville tattoo? Yeah, he's had quite the couple of weeks. I mean, you look at, okay, you win the national championship last night. He was also inducted into the Hall of, or, you know, announced that he will be inducted into the Naismith College Basketball Hall of Fame on Monday morning. His son was named as the head basketball coach at the University of Minnesota. And on Saturday, at the Santa Anita Derby, Rick Pitino's owned horse, Golden Sense, won the Santa Anita Derby. And he'll be competing in the Kentucky Derby coming up in the first Saturday in May. And you bet your bippy I'll have a ticket on Golden Sense to win the opening leg of the Triple Crown. Ironically, in Louisville, Kentucky, right down the road from Churchill Downs is the University of Louisville. And speaking of the University of Louisville, what a year for sports for the University of Louisville. Now, the men's basketball team, of course, has won the national championship. The women compete tonight for the women's national championship. The men's soccer team won the national championship a year ago. Their football team hammered the SEC's Golden Child in Florida in the Sugar Bowl this past year. The University of Louisville right now is riding a major wave of success and one of the top athletic programs in the country right now.
No doubt about that. It's a great time to be a Louisville Cardinal sports fan. Let's talk about next year. Never too early to talk about the favorite or the favorites going into next season's college basketball. I can tell you the odds makers have made Kentucky the odds-on favorite to win it all next year.
Well, they have a whole new roster coming in. So you saw 2 years ago, obviously, last year when they won the national championship with all those heralded freshmen. This year's class, another heralded class, came in. It didn't gel together for John Calipari. And this year's class is expected to be maybe the greatest recruiting class in the history of college basketball. The challenge is all those young guys who are superstar players who never shared the basketball in high school or AAU or any on any playground. There's only one basketball. Can Calipari get those five kids to play defense? Can he get them to share the basketball? Can he get them to play unselfishly? And can you get lucky and win in March? I mean, to go through and win a national championship is not hard. It's not easy. You've got to have a lot of things go your way. Even with the number one overall seed this year in Louisville, there was games that were very close. They were down 13 in the semifinals. They were down big last night in the championship game. They still had to find ways to come back from behind and win. Can a very young team with probably five freshman starters next year do that for John Calipari in Kentucky?
We talked yesterday about how we like proven winners, and that's why we leaned on the Cardinals of Louisville, just because they had a little more experience than the talented Wolverines. The fact that Michigan started three freshmen and two first-year players, and it played out the way that we actually thought it would, which is always nice because it means that we made some money, and that's always the name of the game. We're in Las Vegas, the gambling capital of the world, and I'm looking at, why do you think the scoring has been down overall in college basketball? I mean, again, players today are more athletic than ever before. They have better skills than ever before. But maybe it lends itself more to tremendous defense than anything else, I'm asking.
Well, I think there's a couple things. Number one, the kids aren't around in college long enough. They quickly move from one level to the next, so the coaches don't have a chance to coach them as much to correct a flaw that they might see. A coach like a Tom Izzo or a Roy Williams or a John Calipari, they know that their highly recruited guys might not be around for a couple of years. They're trying to get the most out of them they possibly can in that one summer they have to work with them, and then obviously during the season going through. But there's also, I think, a loss in the transition shot. Gordy Zhang was probably the only guy I watched all year who could consistently make that 15-foot jump shot from anywhere around, from the baseline left or right, from the elbow left or right, from the free throw line, consistently. That middle game is gone in college basketball. It's not developed as much. It's the three-point line, and then obviously down low, power moves, dunks, transition game, that kind of stuff. There seems to be a lost spot there, and probably because I remember, you know, Billy Donovan probably did this, and probably UNLV is maybe partially quote unquote to blame for this, is why take a 2-point shot from 19 feet when I can shoot 1 foot back and get an extra point from it? And I think that's where the college kids and every kid does. They want to shoot the 3-point shot, and they want to make sure they work on their dunks and that kind of thing. There's an art in the middle of the floor that's gone in college basketball right now. It's developed again in the NBA, but it's not in college basketball.
And I think it goes back to 1987 when the NCAA implemented the three-point line. They right. brought that into college basketball. And in fact, this is the lowest scoring season since the three-point line of 1987, 131.2 points per game. And I want to expand on your point, Brett, the fact that you say that the 15-point jump shot is kind of a lost art because, and I get that, and if I were coaching, I would say, listen, I don't want you taking a 15, 18-foot jump shot. I want you to take a step or two back, nail the three,
right,
or layups, low post game, because there's no chance if you're a jump shooter shooting 15, 18 feet out, it's rare that you're going to get fouled. Three, so step back, take a 3-point shot as opposed to a two, and then inside, even if you don't score a high percentage basket, chances are you could get fouled, or you could pick up the three-point play the old-fashioned way.
Well, if you look at it from a percentage standpoint, the average college basketball team probably shoots 35 to 38% from three-point range, and you probably shoot 60-plus percent from inside 5 feet. And the difference is, can I shoot 50 to 55% from the ranges in between? And a lot of kids can't do it. I remember, I didn't play high school basketball, but I remember our high school basketball coach talking to some of our high school players. This is, you know, back just before, during the same time, 1985 or so, before the three-point shot came in, he used to preach to the big guys, shoot that elbow jumper, 9 out of 10. You got to make 9 out of 10. You got to make that shot, you got to make them. You got to, you know. And they would just work on those elbow jump shots like crazy. Those guys, those weren't the guys that would step out and shoot three-point shots. But now you have guys like Kelly Olynyk at Gonzaga, who's 6'11", 6'10", who can step outside and shoot that 20-foot jump shot, and it'd be a three-point shot. So the game has certainly gotten wider. It just, though, I think to me, it's just, if a team can consistently shoot that mid-range jump shot, I think the three-point line doesn't become as important for them to rely on from that standpoint. You know, you don't have to necessarily be a team that makes 8 to 10 to 15 three-point shots in a game to win. If you look at last night, Michigan was 8 of 18 and Louisville was 8 of 16. That's probably a pretty low number of three-point shots attempted in a game. And both teams, one shot 52%, one shot 46% for the game going in. So the shooting percentages were still very high yesterday, and they didn't shoot a lot of the three-point shots.
I'm a numbers guy, so I realize that if you as a team shoot 50% from the field, you're going to win a lot of basketball games. As Charles Barkley once said, the best jump shooter on the planet shoots maybe 40%. So I'm looking at it. If you shoot 33% from the three-point line, that's the equivalent of shooting 50% from inside of three.
Right.
So, again, you'll take 50%. So 33%, I'm surprised that we don't have more teams just taking more three-pointers. Mathematically, it makes sense. And you even said that the average team will shoot 35, 38% from there. So why not just fire up threes and – layups. Those are the only two shot attempts.
I think part of the reasons why they don't do it purely is because when you do miss, those other 65% of the time when you do miss, the other team's got long rebounds and they're running fast breaking on you going the other direction. I guess you got to kind of look at what happens on the two shots that they do miss. Offensive rebounds are, when it comes to a three-point shot, not necessarily in your favor. Because you know the defense has got more time to prepare for a defensive rebounding position. They know the ball's coming up. Where's my man? I've got time to block him out. I'm going to get the rebound. And if it is a long rebound, a lot of times the ball's very quickly going the other way in transition, and you're being scored against if you're not going in there. So I think it's a double-edged sword. Yes, if you're very good and you're making them, there's no question you're right. But on the nights when you don't shoot 35%, obviously we know it's an average. There's days when you're shooting 45, 50%. There's days when you're shooting 20%. On the days when you're shooting 20%, what are you falling back on? How are you scoring on those days? And these are college kids. They're 18, 19-year-old kids. They don't shoot at 50% from three-point range all the time like Louisville did last night. I mean, you look at Spike Albrecht. He was shooting a couple strides over half court and thinking, who is this guy? And I think his teammates were going, who is this guy? He's never done this in practice before. He just had a magical moment where he made four in a row, and it was a huge boost for them, for Michigan going through. But then once that kind of stopped, Michigan in the second half, they weren't making their three-point shots as well.
I think that's a great, great point, because long shots oftentimes will lead to long rebounds, which lead to easy transition baskets back the other way. Right. So nothing beats making your shot.
Well, I think the other thing about why scoring is down this year is because when you look at the number of teams that run their half-court offense, and I talked about this all year with UNLV, I thought in the half-court offense, when a team forced them to play half-court offense and didn't let the Rebels run, they weren't good. They did not run a very good half-court set. And when you rely on jump shooters and you don't get the ball inside, and a team, now you're shooting contested three-point shots, or there's not enough ball movement, or you're not utilizing your strength, which is your inside players, then your shooting percentages are going down. And I thought there were plenty of teams like that this year. I thought New Mexico was another team like that. Half-court offense, not very good. Florida was a team like that. Half-court offense, not very good in spots. I think Michigan at times in a half-court offense wasn't very good. You get these teams out in transition, they were excellent. But when it came to executing half-court, I think that's another flaw of college basketball right now, is the teams don't run their offenses very well.
Friendly reminder that we would love to field live chat questions on Vegas Video Network, and also tap into the studio line, 702-221-7283. I understand that Dave is on the line.
Hey, Scott. Love the show.
Hey, great.
Hey, question for you. With Louisville's win last night, does that automatically make them number one seed next year?
It does not. In fact, it has nothing to do with what might take place next year based on injuries, based on schedule, based on wins and losses. In fact, Brett and I have been talking about the odds makers in Las Vegas have made Kentucky the favorite going into next season. We won't know anything. Of course, 68 teams make it. Four teams are seeded one, and there's no way to know anything as far as what they might do. I remember Louisville in 86, the last time they won the NCAA college basketball tournament, when never nervous Purvis Ellison, I remember talking to a banker who just said, wow, this team is going to have a tremendous run. They have to be the odds-on favorite for next year. They didn't do squat the next year. So enjoy it, savor the moment, but what they did last night has nothing to do with next year.
Oh, it's very difficult to repeat. But also because the players aren't going to be the same. Louisville won't have the same roster next year. They're going to lose several guys from their roster. They'll have new guys to bring in. And you always wonder what Rick Pitino might be thinking. Do I retire? Do I keep going? Do I love the coach some more? Or do I want to own some horses? So you'll find out that in the next couple of weeks. And then, of course, there's the transition year for Louisville as they still – They're with some of the older Big East teams and some of the new Big East teams coming in a new league called the America whatever for 1 year before they go off and run into the ACC going in. And you got to look at other teams that didn't have necessarily the quality of year that you thought they were going to have. A team like North Carolina, you know they're going to be better. Obviously, Duke will be terrific again. Michigan, we know, will be very good. Kentucky, you talked about. Indiana will be good. Kansas is always very good. Florida is always very good. You know, teams like Georgetown. There's plenty of competition out there, and you got to think teams on the West Coast will be improving as well. So it'll be another wide open year. And the one thing about college basketball is the depth is now spread out across the country. It's not in the top 5 to 10 programs anymore. It's in now the top 50 to 75 programs. And there's some great teams that are, you know, in that 35 to 40 range. If somebody gets hot, comes off the radar, nobody would have thought a team like VCU or Butler or back in the day. But now those are sustained, successful programs coming through. So you expect Shaka Smart and Brad Stevens to have very talented teams again next year.
Well, even Wichita State, seeded 9, made right. it to the Final Four this year. Granted, they were a double-digit dog when they took on Louisville. They did cover, and they actually led by 12 points with 13:35 to go in that contest. But I want to address one last time the fact that scoring has been down. And we talked about styles of play. You mentioned the UNLV Running Rebels, tremendous home court team. They're an exciting team. I love going to their games. But they're a different team on the road. They're a different team when the opposition forces them to play a half-court set. I look at it and I think in terms of the Denver Nuggets and even the Golden State Warriors. These are very good regular season teams. But when you look at the Nuggets, a team that's lost 3, maybe 4 home games the entire year where they can control the tempo. Perfect example, Sunday night, Golden State at home, when they can control the tempo, but the Utah Jazz, they prefer to slow it down, play a half-court set, playoff-type basketball team. Another team that comes to mind, the Memphis Grizzlies, they play, that team is made for the playoffs, where the Nuggets, and I love George Karl, the coach for the Nuggets, when he was with Seattle, when he was with Milwaukee, he's a great regular season coach, but that does not equate to being successful in the postseason, because then you're slowing it down, playing in mud, different game altogether.
That's a good point. And I think the other thing, you know, you mentioned Golden State, but if you look at great teams in college basketball, usually you're a great team no matter where you play. But the teams this year have struggled all away from home. Kansas couldn't win on the road. They lost at TCU, which was a terrible basketball team. Florida couldn't win at some of the worst places in the SEC this year on the road. But at home, they don't get beat. Same thing with the Rebels. Obviously, UNLV at home, very, very successful. They're losing games at Fresno State and Boise and places like that. And you're saying, how is it that we can't translate this onto the road to go get some of these road wins going through? And then that immediately puts a lot of pressure on you, knowing that away from the friendly confines of your own arena, that you can't perform. You can't do what you want to do. And it's still a 40-minute game. It's still a shot clock. There's really no difference. It's just a different environment other than the fact that you're playing a team on their home floor. Why can't I do what I normally do? Why can't a team on the road dictate pace like they do at home? Why can't I?
The one constant you'll always have is defense, because you can play defense at home as well as you can on the road. So the one constant you have is defense. But what made this Louisville team so good is the fact that they could beat you so many different ways. And they also had the ability to overcome adversity, because in pro basketball, once the playoffs start, the best team generally will win, because even if you beat the best team, the Miami Heat, congratulations. Now you have to beat them another 3 times to advance. Where in college basketball, that's the curse, but it's also the appeal of the tournament,
right?
Because it's one and done. If you have a bad half, a bad 5-minute stretch, foul trouble, bada bing, bada boom, you're out. See ya. Wouldn't want to be
ya. Well, that's the great thing about sports, sudden death. And that's what the NCAA basketball tournament is all about. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, series, while appealing that you get your team matched up for a long period of time, for me, one of the great appeals in hockey is the sudden death playoffs, not this shootout we have during the regular season. I know going in, they clean the ice. We played three periods. We're tied. We're coming out for the overtime session. And if I blink, the game could be over in 9 seconds. We better have a great shift. We better make that big save. We better get the puck out of our zone. We better take our chances when we can. And it produces exciting end-to-end action. Guys don't sit back and wait and play the neutral zone trap like they might with a 3-2 lead with 5 minutes to go in the game. Now it is literally balls to the wall. We got to score. And that's what I love about it. It is sudden death.
Let's make the transition and talk a little baseball right now. We talked yesterday the fact that a lot of these star stud pitchers are off to a very average start at best, namely R.A. Dickey, Roy Halladay for the Phillies. After last night, Halladay now is 0-2. My question for you is he an aging star on the decline, or is this simply a mini slump? What say you?
I say he's not been the same since Chris Carpenter beat him in Game 5 in the 2011 NLDS in that 1-0 terrific game. He had a bad year last year. His ERA was very elevated. He was very hittable. I think his dominating days are over. I think he'll have good days still yet ahead of him, but right now you watch him, and he is very, very hittable. And you look at yesterday's game, Matt Harvey, who's a potential stud for the New York Mets, was just terrific yesterday on the other side of the mound. And you look at Halladay, he looked like he's aged right before our eyes. In about 18 months, he's gone from being this dominant Bob Gibson-type guy to suddenly being an aging superstar who's getting by and obviously making a lot of money, but he doesn't look very good to me.
Well, last night alone, 4 innings for Halladay, 6 hits, 7 runs.
Yeah, he's not locating very well. He's getting the ball up. He's getting hit hard, and some of that has to do with, you know, there's the, you know, the law of averages where, you know, balls put in play. What's the batting average of the team with balls hit in play going through? But right now, everything the opponents hit are base hits, doubles, triples, and homers.
Well, the thing I look at here in two games for Halladay, 12 innings, or actually 12 runs in just a 7 1/3 innings, and this after a very bad spring training.
And a bad 2011. So you wonder, there's a pattern here now. And you know, one thing that baseball does with the new, you know, the saber metrics that are going on is they project performance moving forward, and they don't rely on what a pitcher's done in his past as much. And obviously that comes into play when it comes to contract status, but his recent form is not very good.
Scott Pritchard alongside Brett Grant. You're listening to The Odds Couple on the world-famous Vegas Video Network and KSHP AM 1400 radio right here in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada. Keep those live chat questions coming on Vegas Video Network. Reach out to us live on the studios for questions about sports, namely sports betting, 702-221-7283. That's 702-221-7283. We're going to keep things moving now with Spin to Win. This is exciting because as a professional sports bettors, we know it's important to think with your head, not your heart. This forces Brett and me to argue a specific game. Tonight, we're looking at Oklahoma City Thunder, -3.5. They're taking on the Utah Jazz, and as we've often said, you can stop the music, but you can't stop the Jazz. We're about to find out, so I'm going to spin the wheel. I will go first. I'll be forced to argue why there's value in the Jazz or the Thunder. Brett automatically has to take the other side. Let's go ahead and spin this bad boy. Thunder from down under. Oklahoma City, -3.5. Here's what you have. I think there's value in taking Oklahoma City because we're talking about a team that is fighting the San Antonio Spurs for the top seed in the Western Conference, and that's very, very important because these two teams are the class of the Western Conference. They met last year in the Western Conference Finals. The Spurs won the first two games, and then Oklahoma City won the next four. This is a big, big must-win game for Oklahoma City. And the reason I see value here, again, I'm a dog player, but I'll lay the points in this case simply because they're the better team, and they're upset. They're upset because they were just embarrassed on national TV on Sunday, and now they trail the San Antonio Spurs by one game after losing to the New York Knicks. They were embarrassed. They were favored by 7.5 points. They lost at home, national TV. Here's what you have. If you have a good team, I'm not talking about the Charlotte Bobcats being embarrassed because that's just another game for them. We're talking about a good team embarrassed, and now they get to redeem themselves against an average Jazz team.
Can I argue with you?
Yes, you may.
No, I got to go on the other side? Oh, man.
You have to take the Jazz.
I agree with you. I don't want to. You know, the Jazz come in, obviously, they have something to play for as well. They're trying to stay ahead of the Lakers, so they're trying to get the 8 seed, I guess, for a potential quick death, maybe against the same team they're going to play tonight. But they got to get to the dance. So obviously the motivation for Utah is to make it into the postseason and keep that lead ahead of the Lakers. Where the Lakers play today against a cupcake team, the Jazz get one of the best teams in the league. So a big, you know, a huge game for Utah. The good thing about it is they're at home going through. We're getting points at home. So anytime a home team is getting points, that's a good thing in my mind. So I think there's some value in that regard. And it does this late in the year come down to motivation. And both teams, while I agree with you, are motivated and OKC is playing for something. They're not playing for their lives. Utah is playing for their lives tonight. I think the Thunder are going to get the best Jazz team they've ever seen tonight going through with Utah because they're fighting for their playoff lives tonight. Different from playoff positioning versus survival.
I remember what Bud Grant, the legendary coach of the Minnesota
Vikings. No relation,
Vikings.
By the way.
I was going to ask. The legendary coach of the Minnesota Vikings back in the 60s and 70s would say, it's not who you play, it's when you play them. And the concern is, as you just said, both of these teams need the game. Utah probably needs it more, and they are dominant at home. But again, the Thunder coming off an embarrassing loss, they're in a must-win. It'll really be interesting to see how this game plays out.
Yeah, it will be. And it's going to come down to – typically in the NBA, when you watch NBA games, you can – pretty much in the regular season, forget the first three quarters. Just turn on the game when the fourth quarter gets underway. And if the home team's down by 8 to 10 points, you know they're going to come back and tie the game. You just know it's going to happen. And they're going to make that run coming through. The thing about the Thunder to me is on the road, Russell Westbrook, does he keep his cool or does he lose his mind? Does he remember he has Kevin Durant or does he forget he has Kevin Durant? Or does he try to do too much? And at times when the Thunder get in trouble, Russell Westbrook tries to do too much, and they got to make sure they keep getting the ball to number 35 over there, who just doesn't seem to miss very often. And when he gets to the free throw line, he never misses going through. You know, Utah, again, to me, is a team. They can be dangerous in times going through, but when you have a team fighting for their lives like this, that's a dangerous thing. When you got them backed up in a corner and you're getting four points, as you mentioned, as a home dog, that's a good place to be, I think.
Well, the Utah Jazz are just a different team at home. On the road, average. I mean, actually, they were 11-27 on the road, but they're dominant at home. Maybe it's high altitude, thin air. I don't know, conducive to Mile High City in Denver. I don't know. I do know they refuse to lose at home. So the points might help you. The thing I look at with this Utah Jazz team is I like their work ethic. They're a blue-collar team, but I want to talk about your point about Russell Westbrook. I think he's the wild card for the Thunder because Kevin Durant is the star. Most point guards are distributors.
Right.
They set everyone else up. But Russell Westbrook is a star player. I love the guy. I love his work ethic. But I think his ego gets in the way sometimes. He tries to take over games late, and it's feast or famine with the guy.
Exactly.
But why not just relent and give it to the star? Give it to Kevin Durant because, as you say, he's 90% from the free throw line. He never misses late in games, and he's a dead-eye shot. So I would rather – if the Thunder go down, I'd rather have them go down with your star player in Durant as opposed to Westbrook.
Well, I think Westbrook wants co-billing. I just don't think – maybe he does with payroll or salary. I just don't think he does necessarily with ability with what happens. That's like saying Mario Chalmers wants the ball versus Dwayne Wade late in the game, and I don't think it works out in Miami's situation when you got two other guys. Obviously, you got LeBron there as well, or somebody wanting the ball in Los Angeles as opposed to Kobe Bryant having the ball at the end of the game. Kevin Durant's your guy. I mean, you look at a Dirk Nowitzki. I think Durant and Nowitzki are very similar with the way they take those shots late in games. You know who's getting the ball, and you know they're going to make it. It's just a matter of making sure they get the ball. In Dallas, Dirk's always got the ball. In OKC, Kevin Durant doesn't always have the ball. And then that comes down to Scott Brooks and coaching, making sure you can try to control what your point guard is supposed to do. And you do have a unique situation in the NBA now. You have a lot of scoring point guards. Chris Paul's the same way, and there's several other guys. Deron Williams is that way. Obviously, Russell Westbrook is that way. There are plenty of guys who believe that, yeah, I got the ball. I'm a scoring point guard. Seth Curry is probably another one of those guys. So you have a little bit of give and take going on about distributing the basketball.
Scott Pritchard with Brett Grant, Odds Couple, Vegas Video Network. We're having a great time, KSHP AM 1400 Radio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Oh, hi. I'm Kelly Clinton. That sucks. I wonder if Joan Rivers is watching.
Oh, please. Oh, my God. Who cares?
I don't have a different one. You know who watches this show? Wayne Newton.
You got that right, Kelly. I think you're absolutely beautiful and talented, young lady. 5, 6, 9, 12. Dog or shit.
More camera time for me.
Hey, I wonder if Cher's watching.
Oh, please. I have so many other things to do.
Woo! Hi, I'm Kelly Clinton. I'm the host of Talk Tales, and you're watching the Vegas Video Network.
Welcome back to The Odds Couple on the world-famous Vegas Video Network, KSHP AM 1400 Radio. My name is Scott Pritchard. Great to have you with us. I'm the founder of PritchardsPicks.com. Check me out, VegasInsider.com. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, sports enthusiast, general manager, KSHP, Brett Grant. We would love for you to continue to be a part of the show. Reach out to us. You can email us at oddscouple@vegasvideonetwork.com. That's oddscouple@vegasvideonetwork.com. Also, we would love to have your voice on our show. Simply go to our site, Vegas Video Network. In the middle of the page, on the right-hand side, red bar, click there. Middle of the page, green bar, start recording. And then also we field live chat questions either through Vegas Video Network, or you could reach out to the studio line, KSHP AM 1400, at 702-221-7283. If you do miss us live, no worries there. You can simply check us out, Vegas Video Network, YouTube, iTunes, Roku. We're talking sports betting, Las Vegas. You don't have to look far to find frustration. Are you kidding me? I'm talking specifically about a baseball game last night, the Texas Rangers taking on the Tampa Bay Rays. It's ninth inning. It's a one-run game, 5-4 Texas, two outs. Joe Nathan, the reliever, is on the mound for the Rangers. 3 balls, 2 strikes to the batter, Ben Zobrist, and it was practically in the dirt. And the batter was halfway down the first base line, and the umpire said, "Strike three, you're out of here." Joe Nathan, the relief pitcher, was shell-shocked. He mouthed the words, "Wow, did he call that a strike?"
Yes,
so Madden for the Rays, obviously very upset. I mean, it was the game, the stud horse on deck. You know, you never know what's going to
Montgomery
happen in baseball.
On deck, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what you have...
Who was 3 for 3, by the way, waiting in the wings.
Right, exactly. And Marty Foster was the home plate umpire who made the call. Are you kidding me? In defense of Marty Foster, unlike a lot of refs, unlike a lot of officials, after the game he said, listen, at least he manned up. He said, listen, I made a mistake. If I had to do it over again, it would have been ball four.
Apparently he was drinking some Fosters before that. I think that was the problem going into it.
You know, did see this, though, right?
I did. And, you know, the funny thing about it, it was Joe Nathan's 300th save, so it was a big deal. And he's getting ready to blow it. A run's already in. It's 5-4. It was 5-3. This walks Ben Zobrist. It brings up Evan Longoria. And you think that, obviously, the save is very much in jeopardy after the walk. And I was online last night, and I'm hearing some people say, it's not where the guy catches the ball, it's where it crosses the plate. And I went, the ball still hasn't crossed the plate. The ball was 4 to 5 inches wide of the plate. It was low. It was nowhere near a strike. And this is, we were just talking about this yesterday with these calls that are sometimes just so egregious. I understand everybody makes mistakes. Umpires obviously have their mistakes amplified, by a million times because all of us are watching. And now with YouTube and all the other places to see this video, Mr. Foster, unfortunately, will never live down this moment of him calling a strike. The only good thing that happened was it was in April. It wasn't in October. Now, let's say that exact situation came up. It was Game 7 of the American League Championship Series, and that was the call. And that was the go-ahead run being walked, your best hitter coming to the plate. Now what do? You live with that mistake? Or do we say, you know what, we got to find a way to fix this? Because obviously that was a horrific call by a home plate umpire that could have been changed with replay or a coach's challenge or some way. If it cost a team a pennant versus a game in April, I got a problem with that.
Well, I have a problem with it as well, but I don't know. I don't think replay is the answer because you rotate the home plate umpires, and it's subjective. It's one person's strike zone compared to another person's strike zone. It's up to you as a batter to adjust accordingly. Now, you can't adjust to that.
I wouldn't have a little league kid swing at that pitch.
The guy just blew it. But guess what? You know, players blow it every day.
Right.
You know, players swing at, you know, Josh Hamilton's a great example. Against lefties, he'll swing at anything.
Right.
So it's in the dirt. He swings.
He does.
So, I mean, you can't make the umpire the scapegoat. I do respect and admire the fact that he did man up and admitted. Because I've seen worse, believe it or not, and they don't man up, and they still stand by their decision because they're egomaniacs.
Right.
But in this case, at least in defense of Marty Foster, he did man up and say, listen, I made a mistake, and if I had to do it over again, it would be ball four. Now, that does not make the Tampa Bay Rays feel any better,
right,
but it is what it is.
That's for sure.
What do you have going with Are You Kidding Me?
Well, you know, growing up in being a Missouri football fan, I watched Nebraska kick the living daylights out of Missouri football my entire life. So I grew to hate the University of Nebraska football program. But they did something so nice over the weekend. Are you kidding me? I can't hate them anymore. At their spring game, they had 65,000 people at Memorial Stadium in Lincoln, Nebraska. And they brought out a 7-year-old boy suffering from brain cancer named Jack Hoffman. And they had him in a helmet, had him in uniform. I don't think he was wearing shoulder pads, but he had on the pants and the jersey, Husker jersey, and they brought him out. And Taylor Martinez brought the Huskers out of the huddle, and they set him up for a run. And there was little 7-year-old Jack Hoffman set up on the left side of the formation. They handed him the ball, and he started running straight. The defensive end crashed to the inside. He had a wide open lane on the left side of the line. And then for some reason, he made a right turn, and it was student body right, and he went towards the sideline, and up the lane he went and made a left turn, and he galloped 69 yards for a touchdown. Once he got to the second level, those Nebraska defenders had no chance to catch him going through, and Jack Hoffman scored a 69-yard touchdown in the spring game for the Nebraska Cornhuskers against that black shirt defense that was so heralded that scored gave up, I think, 70 points to Wisconsin, by the way, at some point during the regular season.
Right.
But just a great move by Nebraska football, and I can't hate him anymore. So are you kidding me, Huskers? I can't hate you anymore for that very, very classy move on Saturday afternoon.
That's a great feel-good story. Again, being from the Midwest, born and raised in Iowa, no love lost between Nebraska and Iowa, namely because whenever we would play Nebraska, they would stick it to us as
right.
well. But I'm trying to figure out why. Wow, is there really nothing else to do in Nebraska that 60 to 65,000 fans show up for a scrimmage?
Correct. There's nothing else to do. You know, the amazing thing about Nebraska, when they fill the stadium on Memorial Stadium up on Saturday afternoons, it becomes the second largest city in the state of Nebraska, just inside that stadium. So Omaha and the stadium is pretty much it going through. So other than working in the field, playing a little golf, doing whatever, it's probably, well, last Saturday was actually probably the first day they didn't have any snow on the ground for quite a while in Nebraska. But, yeah, college football, and we talk about football in America, it is certainly the number one sport right now, and college football is not far behind the NFL. And these spring games are very, very popular going through to see what's happening. We had 74,000 people at the basketball game last night. How many people? I mean, 74,000 people watching a little ball on a small court in a monster football arena is one thing, but 74,000 watching on the 100-yard field on a beautiful Saturday afternoon was a nice day.
Boy, we're seeing that on the network. That's pretty cool.
There
the 7-year-old making the touchdown run, 7-year-old kid with brain cancer. Now, this is the first chance I've had to actually see that. I've heard, and I'm going to check it out when I get home. It's posted everywhere on YouTube, so for viewers or listeners, you can certainly check that out. So a great, great story.
It was. And, you know, and for Jack Hoffman, a moment he'll never forget. And hopefully with his treatment of cancer, that he'll have a recovery and go through it. But obviously Nebraska has adopted, the football players have adopted this young boy to be part of their team. And they made him a very special memory for him and his family. So great move by Nebraska.
You're listening to The Odds Couple on the world-famous Vegas Video Network. Scott Pritchard from PritchardsPicks.com, joined by Brett Grant. Great having you with us. This is the part of the show where Brett and I together, we're going to put money into your pocket as we together put you on the right side. Major League Baseball, we have the Houston Astros. They've lost 6 consecutive games. They're taking on the Seattle Mariners. And the side for this game. Before I get to this, I do want to recap what took place yesterday. Brett and I talking about the NCAA college basketball tournament. We went on record as saying when we wrapped up the show, we liked Louisville minus the points. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. They ended up winning by 6, 82-76 final score. We also like the over 137.5. It floated from 137 to 139, but again, an easy winner as it fell 82-76. That's 158 points, so we won by 20.5 points. Now, baseball play for the right side yesterday fell out. We're not going to talk about that. We're going to get right to today's baseball. The Houston Astros, again, we like...
I don't remember what it was myself, so way to go.
We like riding the streaks, the right. Over in the Yankee game, if I remember right. I've been trying to forget the losers, but the Astros have lost
over.
Six.
It went way, it was the, way over.
Well, then we won again.
We won. We won
again. I made so many bets.
I did forget what the play was, but it certainly went over the total.
The eight. The closing total was 8. So
it
another
was 11
easy
to
winner.
6.
Okay.
It was
great. I need to check my math.
You had 100% more runs than you needed.
Wow. So I won again.
Exactly.
Even when I think I lose, I win.
Check your bank account.
Wow. I better hang on to that ticket. Over 8 with the Yankees yesterday.
I hope
yesterday.
You didn't burn it last night. Yeah.
Well, no.
It was a little cold. You may have fire going, need a little kindling. Might have burnt that ticket.
I've been known to lose winning tickets by misplacing them. Don't ask me how or why, but it has happened. That's why now, they force me to use a player's card when I make bets because they want to track my plays. They will not take a bet unless I give them a betting card.
That's a nice thing also about online play. Now with the apps, you don't have to worry about a ticket. Right.
So, wow. Yeah, I'm trying to think. My play yesterday for the right side was over in the Yankee game, and that was a winner. I had over 8. Mm-hmm. So, wow. Hey, we win again. We'll take it.
You're undefeated.
I can't lose. I can't be beat. Like
oops,
Mike Tyson.
We're screwed today.
No doubt. Because Mike Tyson in 89 was going on record. I can't be beat. I refuse to lose. And Buster Douglas knocked him out as a 40 or 50 to 1 shot.
Yes, he did.
All right, today, Houston Astros, 6 straight losses. We never bet on a streak to end. I think $1.45 with Seattle at home is cheap. Ring up the ringer, see the cashier.
No, where's the bell? Ring the bell.
Ring the bell. Bell, bell.
There it is.
All right.
All right. That bell's got legs.
Do you have a play
today? I don't
know
how it got over. I do. I'm going to stick to baseball as well. I'm going to go to a game in the American League today between the champion, American League West champion Oakland A's, and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim / California / Gene Autry / we've got more names than Liz Taylor has husbands going through this. C.J. Wilson, not a good start in his first time out, and also not a very good start either for Parker going through. Both these guys struggled in spring training. Both these guys struggled in their first starts of the season. Why would they suddenly get it together today? I like this game to go, as you would say, Red Rover. I love the over in the game today with A's and the Angels.
He loves the over in the Angels-A's contest. A's have won 5 straight games. What's going on with the Angels? Jared Weaver, their star ace, out 4 to 6 weeks.
Well, he looked like he was laboring a little bit in the Sunday night game a bit, and I guess that's kind of what happened. You know, when you these injuries that happen early in the year, you wonder if they got the proper work in spring training, or were they hiding something through spring training going through. His velocity looked down a little bit against Yu Darvish on Sunday night, and obviously that's always a telltale sign when it comes to pitchers, where suddenly when you're used to throwing 93-ish and now you're suddenly throwing 89 at the start of the game, it's one thing to start at 93 and be at 89 towards the end of the game, but when you're only there in the second inning, there's a sign there's something wrong with your arm. And, you know, his brother had some issues, and they're built very similarly. They threw very similarly, where velocity dropped down quite a bit. And with his unique lanky motion that he has, he's probably more susceptible to some kind of arm issue than a power pitcher like a Justin Verlander might be.
Right side for Brett and myself today. I'm taking Seattle minus the 45 cents. He's playing the over in the A's-Angels contest. I want to talk a little bit about NBA basketball jersey sales.
Right.
LeBron James.
In New Jersey or just jersey sales in general?
Just jersey sales, period. Nothing to do with Jersey Boys, which is a great show, by the way,
exactly.
In Las Vegas at Paris. I have to say that Carmelo Anthony is a star player for the Knicks. We all know that. But LeBron James is the best basketball player on the planet. But just now, Carmelo Anthony has outsold him with jerseys. Your thoughts?
It's all about New York. New York, New York, New York. Big the world around, revolves around New York City. Whether you like it or not, that's where it is. And when people in New York get excited, they can outbid and outperform anybody else in the country. So Miami, while being a big market, and LeBron obviously being a superstar, he's not well-liked in New York. So when you get those motivated Knicks fans going out and suddenly buying Carmelo jerseys, it doesn't shock me that they would have beat him. It's ironic, I think, when it comes to jersey sales, that Michael Jordan, who hasn't played a game in a decade, is probably still one of the top jersey sellers in the NBA still to this day. His jersey sells as well as anybody else's does.
Interesting you bring up Michael Jordan, because I have to tell you that I can remember when Dennis Rodman played for the Chicago Bulls, I believe it was 3 years, and he would paint his hair pink and orange, and number 91, I believe,
yes,
was his
was.
Jersey
yep.
number. And I remember watching the Bulls warm up, and there were more kids and adults with Rodman jerseys than Jordan jerseys.
That's because they lost their Jordan jerseys on the golf course gambling to
Maybe.
Michael
Well,
himself.
That would make sense. That would make sense.
It.
But I think that goes back to marketing, because, I mean, Rodman, his life changed as soon as he hooked up with Madonna in more ways than one.
Right.
Because she instilled in him marketing. That's when he turned into a freak, painting the hair, doing goofy, silly things.
Right.
Hasn't stopped. He's solving all of our defense problems going over to North Korea.
I think he's actually accelerated the problem of North Korea from what I'm seeing these days going through. You know, I mean, I lived in Chicago during that time when the Bulls were winning all those championships, and Michael Jordan was everywhere. He was on every commercial. Forget the Hanes commercials now. He was endorsing the local Chevy dealer. He was selling this. He was selling that. He was everywhere. You couldn't turn on your television set and not see Michael Jordan during the heyday of the Bulls in the early 1990s. And then, of course, he decided to go play a little baseball in Birmingham, Alabama. And even then, of course, then it was the comeback and all the things that were going on with him there. And then that's when Rodman and Scottie Pippen were trying to carry the banner themselves. It didn't work out so well for the Bulls. And then, of course, Jordan comes back and boom, 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 they win again a couple more times. Dennis Rodman is an interesting animal in that regard. And to me, with the Carmelo Anthony story, is a little bit of an anomaly, because usually it associates with winning and championships. I can understand Derek Jeter's jersey selling as well as it does, because the Yankees equal winning and Jeter's their leader. Carmelo Anthony hasn't won anything in the NBA ever.
Right. He won at Syracuse as a freshman, the national championship. Right. I believe it was 2003. But, I mean, in the NBA, didn't do anything in Denver. Star player, scores a lot of points, but does he make the team better? I'm not convinced.
It's debatable.
Well, actually, Denver's gotten better since he left.
Right.
And, of course, the Knicks have gotten better since D'Antoni left.
Yeah.
Now, I want to back up just for a second.
Have the Lakers gotten better since D'Antoni arrived?
No, I don't think so. In fact, their
best
coach.
You think Mike Brown is having a nice smile during this late run of them not making the playoffs?
Probably. I mean, Mike Brown started out 1-4. That's unacceptable. But I think they pulled the string too soon. Although Bernie Bickerstaff probably has the best win percentage, the interim coach before they brought in D'Antoni.
Right. Good point.
Well, no one ever accused D'Antoni when he played in Italy or when he coached the Phoenix Suns of ever playing any defense. I will say that when I used to cover the Chicago Bulls back in the day, old Chicago Stadium, their locker room was smaller than my high school locker room in Northeast Iowa growing up on the farm. And I remember talking to Michael Jordan one-on-one on more than one occasion, and he was always so cordial, so conversational and real. The Chicago media loved Michael Jordan because he made himself accessible. He wasn't full of himself in that regard. And, of course, he won basketball games. I also remember interviewing Bill Cartwright, the 7-foot center for the Chicago Bulls, and he was stretched out on the floor. And basically, there was
Took up the whole locker room.
He absolutely did. Yes. And I just kneeled down. I said, "Hey, Scott Pritchard, radio, I'd like to get a quick interview." And he had his arms up over his head, and he looked up at me and said, "Okay." I said, "Well, are you going to stand up?" "No, we'll do it right here." So he's laying down, basically taking a nap, and I conducted the interview with him. But he always sounded like Bill Cosby.
He
sounded like Fat Albert, man,
exactly.
I'm telling you.
Well, I've been in those locker rooms because I covered some hockey events at Old Chicago Stadium and interviewed some hockey players as well. And there's nothing like interviewing a hockey player when he's standing there buck naked and you've got to ask him a question. And you're saying, "Can you put some clothes on?" "No, we're all good." But you're right. Those locker rooms were tiny. And speaking of Chicago and sports real quick, Wrigley Field has announced, the family that owns Wrigley Field, the Ricketts, they're going to put a $500 million renovation into Wrigley Field. And speaking of locker rooms, the weight room for the Cubs is about as big as a studio. And the office of the manager is about as big as good old Jake is sitting back here. I mean, it's just tiny, antiquated, 100-year-old building, basically. So they're going to be putting $500 million into Wrigley Field, and I wonder what it's going to look like. But it is, you know, Chicago Stadium was that way. Fenway Park is that way. These are old, antiquated buildings. They don't have the modern amenities. Yes, they have the romanticism of being these old, beautiful ballparks, and we love them, and we don't want to tear them down. But when you go inside the bowels of Fenway Park and Wrigley Field, you'd think they should be torn down.
Yeah, you know, that's what they did in Chicago with Soldier Field just a few short years ago. I'm old school, so I'm not a big fan of them doing anything to Wrigley Field. The only thing I hope is that the Cubs eventually one day in my lifetime start winning. I mean, it was 1908 the last time they actually won a World Series, 1945.
So you're one of those miscast farm boys from Iowa that happens to root for the Cubs, huh?
This is going to wrap up this edition of the Odds Couple on the world-famous Vegas Video Network and KSHP AM 1400 Radio. My name is Scott Pritchard. Once again, thanking Brett for being here.